What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I'm your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Chris Johnson. Chris Johnson is a film writer, director, and producer whose career began in the visual effects arena. Johnson designed and created the special makeup effects for the cult favorite Drop Dead Fred, and created special makeup effects for Michael Mann's iconic film The Last of the Mohicans. Johnson made his directorial debut with the feature film Outside of Winter's Bend. This was followed by the supernatural thriller Shades of Darkness and Summer of Tomorrows, which was re-edited for a special international release in 2010. Johnson's latest film, the documentary and feature hybrid, Journey to Royal, a World War II rescue mission, produced through his own Misty Falls Motion Picture Company, was recently released. The story recounts the last rescue mission of his great-uncle, World War II rescue pilot and hero, Lieutenant Royal A. Stratton. Johnson is also a former Walt Disney Imagineer, which we get into as well. In addition to all this, we also discuss our shared love of storytelling and the sense of responsibility that both him and I have in collecting these stories and how they relate to history. He even tells me during the interview that he views storytelling as the most important thing in Western civilization. And now I give you Chris Johnson. Okay, I'm here with Chris Johnson. Chris, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Josh. Pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. I'm really excited to talk with you, Chris, about your life, your career, what you're doing currently. But before we do, please tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure. I'm a filmmaker, and that's sort of a broad umbrella. You know, I write, direct, edit. Throughout my career, I've had the opportunity to do numerous aspects of that process. I started off doing special makeup effects, some films like Drop Dead Fred, Last of the Mohicans. And then I moved into visual effects for things like Poseidon, Final Destination, and then came back around to directing. After Mohicans, I went into directing for a while, and then I went into visual effects, and then I went into Imagineering with Disney, and then I came back to writing and directing. So I've really had the opportunity to experience a lot of the aspects, different professions within the overall craft of filmmaking. And so I feel like I've been really fortunate that way.
Yeah, that's awesome, Chris. Thank you. So what was it that piqued your interest in film and filmmaking? Did you start off young or did you find it later on?
I feel like this is kind of a stereotypical story. You know, my dad, he took some great movies when I was a kid. And so at 3 or 4 years old, I had a basic understanding of what he was doing. He used an instrument to record images that he would later project for the family. And there was something compelling about what he was doing. And so my interest was sparked for that from that on. And then, you know, as a child, you watch TVs like Happy Days and then into the movies, things like Superman and Star Wars. And all of these things influenced a whole generation of storytellers and filmmakers. And I was, you know, not unique in that capacity. You know, I was one of the people that was influenced by those pictures. And so at a very young age, I knew that I wanted to participate in filmic storytelling, the assembly of images and sound to construct an experience that moved you in ways that other storytelling couldn't. So that was how it all started. And then the way I literally got into the film business was when I was in high school, I saw Nightmare on Elm Street. And of course, Freddy Krueger has this very scarred visage, and it's all created through the magic of special makeup effects, first by David Miller on the original and the parts five, six, and seven, and then by Kevin Yeager on parts 2, 3, and 4. And, you know, as you do in high school, you talk about the things that you saw over the weekend and whatnot. And somebody tried to convince me that Freddy Krueger was an actual bird victim and that that was the only role he ever got. And, well, that sparked my interest because I knew that was nonsense. And as I delved into the process, it harkened back to a book I'd seen. Sorry, this is a little long-winded.
No, not at all.
But it harkened back to a book I had seen in my elementary school library called Stage Makeup by Richard Corson. And in that book, it had a beautiful spread of Dick Smith's makeup on Dustin Hoffman for Little Big Man, which was, he changed Dustin Hoffman from a 34-year-old actor to a 120-year-old character. And it, to my young eyes, it was perfection. And to even now, that makeup is astonishingly well-crafted and well-executed. Dick Smith, of course, the godfather of makeup, created that. And so that aspect of storytelling was also intriguing to me. So I started studying that. And it was through that that I actually landed my first jobs in the business on things like Drop Dead Fred and Last of the Mohicans. So that's my encyclopedic kind of, you know, thread about how I kind of find myself working, lucky enough to be working in a business that's very, very competitive and difficult to stay in.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. No, I appreciate you setting the table there for us. Lots to discuss there on the back of it. So one thing I'm really excited to talk to you about, I know that you used to be an Imagineer for Disney. And perhaps I'll phrase it this way. For our audience, what exactly is an Imagineer and what was that experience like?
So I think the way, if I were to speculate, the way that the term Imagineer came about, it's obviously the marriage of the words imagination and engineering, right? So Walt Disney, when he was conceptualizing Disney World originally, this had not been done before. So he put together this team of architects, engineers, artists to birth this thing from his imagination into reality. And this team of people, you know, they obviously coined the phrase Imagineering somewhere along the way, and Imagineer is sort of the manifestation of the marriage of those disciplines. And so Imagineering as a whole, it comprises the creative force, both artistically and in engineering, that conceptualize, design, and create the attractions that ultimately become the Disney World or Disneyland experience. And so it's evolved over the years, and there are separations, divisions of labor. You know, there's the artist and the concept people, and then there's the architects who then take that and then back that into what, you know, code and facility and theming. And then there's model makers that literally build miniaturized version of what will be the final product. And then, you know, of course, then it goes to execution on a full scale in the park itself. And so I was in the division of Imagineering that took the architecture, the architect's plans and drawings, and executed that in miniature and scale so that we would build many different scales of an attraction so that you could work out the problems so that when you got to real world, as many of those problems were solved as possible before you had to do it in a costly sense with brick and mortar and theming and things like that. And, you know, I don't have any formal architecture training, but as a person who's worked in the visual arts my entire life and just happened to be meticulously detail oriented, I kind of gravitated toward that discipline because it satiated some desire to craft things in a very articulate and detailed way to strict specifications. It's a, before I'd worked at Imagineering, it's not that I wasn't a fan of this, but it's just that it wasn't really on my radar. And it's like, oh, you know, attractions, theme parks, fun thing for kids. But after I understood kind of the behind the scenes and what really went into making those things function, it blew my mind, the level of science and technology married with imagination to bring those things to the world. That's a remarkable, remarkable thing, and a privilege, absolute privilege to have been able to participate in that process as long as I did.
Yeah, no, extraordinary. Thank you, Chris. You know, I'm curious. So I used to be a project manager in product management. And one of the things I was thinking about as you were talking was timeline, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, and maybe there's no real answer to this, but was there a specified timeline that you had to adhere to for any given type of product? Or I imagine it would vary by the product.
Oh, within Disney, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you know, oftentimes, and part of this is speculative because I kind of focused on the aspects of the process that I was literally engaged to do. So even though I had a sort of an overall concept of their conception of the thing and when the park had to open, I wasn't into that in a granular way, the way that other departments were. So I knew that for us, we would be a project would be brought to us, and we would have a certain amount of time to complete the physical model and present it. And then there'd be a certain amount of time for iterations of changes, change orders that would come to solve certain problems. And a park opening, look, this is like any business where real world versus your schedule and your concept of a thing, filmmaking included, you're adhering to a schedule based on thousands of moving parts, sometimes tens or hundreds of thousands of moving parts. And so it's somewhat fluid within that model in terms of the start date and the opening date. And everybody that works within that larger paradigm is aware that, okay, we have to be fluid within this to a certain degree. The short answer is yes. There's a time frame. There's an idea. They want the attraction of the park or the update to open on XYZ date. But within that, you know, whether if development ran over, maybe the model went shorter, or if the development was quick, you know, get what I'm saying is that you sort of adjust to accommodate your colleagues because you're all on the same team ultimately. And despite the fact that there's always bean counters somewhere in the system, you know, trying to wedge you into something shorter than you would want, which is the case in, I think, any creative endeavor. Aside from that, you know, you're just a team of people trying to create something that you hope is cutting edge and that excites people in the way that it has excited you throughout the entire process. Because sometimes, you know, the concept of a park to opening, that's a long period of years and hundreds of millions of dollars. And to have a sustained interest and energy to bring that from concept to fruition is ultimately the driving force, the organizing principle, is the excitement that you collectively bring to the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Chris. My last question on Imagineering, then I'll move on. I'm curious if there was a particular project that you worked on that stood out for you for whatever reason.
You know, they all stand out for different reasons. One of the first things I did there was the Ko'olina Alani hotels and that resort out there. And it was the first time I'd really done contributed to an architectural study of an actual area that exists that was going to be built somewhere. And that, you know, Nicholas Meyer, one of your previous interviews, he's talking about how things influence you at certain stages in your life and how they resonate in a way because of your age or because of the newness of something. And this was one of those moments where it was like being in kindergarten or grammar school for the first time, where this new world opened up to you and you recognized your ability to affect an outcome and interact with the students or your fellow creatives. And it made an indelible impression. So that, because that was the first, that was kind of like a seminal moment with Imagineering. And then, you know, I worked on the Cars Land, and that made an impression just because of the scope of the world that they were creating. When, I don't know if you've been to the attraction in Southern California, but Cars Land is an immersive experience where you're walking into a Monument Valley based on that film. And everywhere you look, it's immersive. You're in the experience, you're in that world. And that made an impression just because of the vast architecture of the landscape and the numerous moving parts that were part of that. I got to work on Ratatouille that is in France, and that was innovative because it dealt with a different kind of ride system. And so, you know, and then, you know, I participated in Avatar and Star Wars, and these were all things that are birthed from different intellectual properties that, aside from the attractions in the theme park world, they have a life of their own, and they've impacted anybody who went to see the first Avatar was likely impacted in the way that they hadn't been before, because James Cameron's on the cutting edge of bringing new experiences to you. And this was going to be an extension of that. So you have an idea of what it's going to be, and then when you see it begin to be fleshed out in the real world, how do you create floating mountains? How do you create, you know, different things like that that became right. Track? Every time it's something new in the best case scenario. So every project that I was privileged enough to participate on in Imagineering left an indelible mark somewhere in my creative memory, you know. So I can't speak highly enough of the people that work there and the craft. It's remarkable. It's remarkable. And again, I'm privileged to have been able to participate.
Yeah, man, that's incredible. Thank you, Chris. You know, we've mentioned it a few times now already. I'm really chomping at the bit to discuss it. So, yes, you worked on the cult classic Drop Dead Fred. I believe you designed and created the special makeup effects. I can't help but notice a picture on one of your monitor screens there, right behind you. And I'm curious how you became involved in that and what that experience was like.
This had a tie. The way I got involved with Drop Dead Fred is kind of interesting in that I was 18 at the time. I just graduated high school. I was in the process of moving from New York to Los Angeles to, as many people, pursue this fanciful career in filmmaking and the world of the movies. And I had my interest in Freddy Krueger and the craft of creating special makeup effects. I'd been doing that for years at this point in time. And I had perfected a characterization of Freddy Krueger such that I would go to the conventions. And if you didn't know Robert Englund, who plays Freddy, or David Miller's or Kevin Yeager's makeup in an intimate sense, meaning you hadn't ever seen it in person, the lay person might encounter me and think, wow, is that the guy? Because seeing something on screen and then seeing it in person, sometimes you can walk, see an actor that you well know on screen, but when you see them in person, you're asking yourself, is that them? So I would go to these conventions, the Fangoria conventions, different types of things like that, made up as Freddy Krueger. And on one occasion, I had the good fortune to speak to a storyboard artist who'd done the storyboards for a couple of that Nightmare on Elm Street films. His name's Pete Vacciali. And, you know, I was a rather shy, kind of retiring teenager. And when I put the makeup on, it allowed me to sort of come out of my shell a little bit. And then my dad, who was with me at the time, because I was just a teenager, he's the one that coaxed me. He said, go talk to him. Just go talk to him. Have a conversation. See why he does what he does, what his involvement was. So anyhow, I did. I went up to talk to him, and Pete and I became friends ever since. And he's responsible for recommending me for Drop Dead Fred. And the way that worked was they had a guy named Steve Johnson, I think, who was originally going to do the makeup effect. Now, Steve Johnson, I don't know Steve Johnson, but I've seen his work. I know the history of his work. He's a remarkable craftsman, a great talent in the business. And he, for whatever reason, backed out. I don't know whether he had another picture or there's conflicting schedules. It's pure speculation. But Pete then recommended me. This was a lower budget picture. They needed somebody immediately. And I had the guy's last name, Johnson. And I think somewhere along the lines, they must have thought, oh, it must be related. Oh, well, look at this guy. So circumstances being what they were on their end and mine, I was lucky enough to get the job. Now, this was, again, I was 18. I had done a lot of makeup effects on my friends and school plays. I knew the A to Z on the basics of the craft. I think I read everything that was available at the time, and I was fairly confident and knew that, okay, within certain parameters, I can create certain kinds of special makeup effects for a picture. And so I got the job. And then the job immediately went beyond the scope of my experience. I had to create exploding head with cuckoos and things that came out for this character called Velcro Head. And this flat face, the flat face prosthetic for Rick was more the standard special makeup effects, but there were little gags in the picture along the way that were things I had done, but I could conceptualize how I could take what I did know and sort of extrapolate, you know, follow a logical path to figuring those things out. But it was both a wondrous and terrifying experience in that I was so far in over my head and that I'd never been on a film set before. But at the same time, I was in charge of this department, the special makeup effects. I was the supervisor, the creator. There was nobody else. And it was good fortune that I was able to get the job, and all thanks to Pete and my father by extension. And it was a loving set that the people that made Drop Dead Fred, they went out of the way to create a family atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Paul Lynch, the producer, he was like a father figure of sorts in that he always checked in and was asking how it was going and if I needed anything. And Kevin Kuchever, who did the visual effects on the picture, one of many that worked in that arena on the film, I understood from having watched this new release that just came out last year, there was a behind the scenes kind of making up that they were kind enough to ask me to be included in it, you know. And in that, Kevin had revealed that the production had asked him specifically to look out for me, because I was just this young kid on this picture, my first job. And he did. And he didn't do it in an overt way. He became a friend. And he helped me have the confidence to follow my instincts. And the result was what became in the picture. All of the gags worked. Most of them were in the film. That flat face has become sort of, I don't know, it's the iconic, one of the iconic images from the film. And right out of the gate, that was my first job. And to have something like that, that's probably, that may end up being the most iconic thing, you know, I do. I mean, who knows where your path will go, but I see it everywhere. Memes, Facebook, Instagram and stuff. And it's really heartwarming. And the wrap up on that experience specifically is Rick Mayall. Rick Mayall, who was Fred, was one of these sweetest, just loveliest people that I've ever had the chance to know and work with. And we both had a certain inexperience. He was well-versed in his craft. When I say inexperience, I don't think he'd ever had a full face life cast done before. And I'd never been in a film before. And I remember him asking, he said, you a little nervous? I said, I am a little nervous. And he said, let me guess, it's your first film and you want to make a good impression. You want everybody to see what you do and know that you're capable and you want it to do a great job. You know, you're concerned. It's your first time out. So I was like, yes, that's exactly it. You know, I appreciated him saying that because he cut through NBS and he's just got to the heart of it. And then he said, you're going to do great. It's going to be fantastic. And when we were doing the life cast, I started putting it's a process. You put alginate on the face. For your listeners who may not know the life casting process, you put, it's the same material. Back then, it was the same material you used to do dental impressions.
Oh.
And you smear it all over a person's face or head, and you back it with plaster bandage for rigidity because it's a gelatinous kind of material that cures. And when you take it off, you fill that with a dental stone, plaster, and you get a positive relief of the person's face. And from that, you sculpt the prosthetics that you'll later mold and create the foam latex, literal prosthetics that you glue onto the actor's face. And so as I was doing this, you covered the nose and the mouth and you only leave the nostrils. And as I started, he said, talk to me, Chris. And so I talked him through the process. And it turns out that both he and I were able to help each other over the hump of that experience in the makeup effects aspect of that film and just kind of help each other through the process and make it a success together. And I'll never forget his generosity of spirit that gave me the confidence to just follow my instincts, him and Kevin and Paul Webster and Mary McLaglen, who was the production manager on that film. I remember that like it was last week. And I wish I could see some of those people again, because I'd love to tell them what a great experience it was and that it resonates with me all these years later.
Wow. No, that's wonderful, Chris. Thank you so much for sharing that. Just out of curiosity, so presumably was the flat face your idea?
Well, the flat face was in the script. So
yeah,
the script said something about him putting his head in a refrigerator and stretching his neck to extricate himself. And as he did it, it comes out and it's squashed flat. And then Pete Bonchali had done, the storyboard artist from Elm Street was doing the storyboards for Drop Dead Fred. That was the connection. And he had done some boards of the sequence. So I had an idea what people were thinking about in terms of what this was going to be. But because the schedule in that picture was so short and the budget was such that we couldn't normally sculpt a maquette, then from the maquette, you'd make some changes. That's a maquette. It's just like a quarter scale or half scale rough sculpt. It's like a physical sketch. I mean, that's like a sculpture sketch, rather, is what I mean. And we didn't have time to do any of that. So I drew up some sketches at my hotel room in Minneapolis, brought it to a production meeting. The director signed off on it. And the next time I saw the director was literally on the day the makeup had already been applied. So it was that kind of breathtaking experience where you're like, is it going to fly? Is it going to work? But then, you know, I went back to Los Angeles. I had just moved there. I didn't have a shop. Sandy Berman, who worked, I don't know how granular you want to get. Sandy Berman at the time, she owned Berman Foam Latex and was the premier supplier of special makeup effects materials in the industry at the time. And Sandy and I had become friends, and she was like a mother to everybody in the makeup business, from people like John Caglione and Doug Drexler, who had done Dick Tracy, and they were actually had a shop in the back of her store. Hmm. And I bring that up because John and Doug were gracious enough with Sandy's help to allow me to use part of their studio to run the foam latex, to bake the appliances in their oven. And that's how I got to know them a little bit. And Doug Drexler, actually still friend to this day. And helped on my last picture. But you know how they say it's a small world?
Yeah.
The film industry is such a small, small world. And the people that you meet, there, it's a smaller pool than you think. And right out of the gate on that picture, I just was fortunate enough to meet artists that their talent, it boggles my mind. Some of the people I've had the good fortune to interface with. And I've learned from every single one of them. And in any case, so I went back to LA. I created these prosthetics. I sculpted them. I don't know how I did it so fast. I attribute it to the fact that I was 18. Because I look back now and I think, could I do it on that kind of a compressed timeline today? And I don't know whether I become more detail-oriented or more that my expectations of the work are higher so that it requires more time, or that just in my youth, I had more energy and I worked 18 hours a day for 2 weeks. I'm not sure what the truth of that chemistry is, that metric, but in any case, I got back to set. We did the gags. And through that process, the first assistant director, his name's Michael Waxman, he became a very good friend. And he's the reason that I got Last of the Mohicans the following year. He gave me a call over the winter and said, I'm working with Michael Mann, Thief, Miami Vice, Manhunter, and Daniel Day-Lewis, of course, Academy Award for My Left Foot. And I mean, I was young. I knew of those people. I certainly knew Miami Vice, but I didn't, at the time, I just didn't have the concept of the depth of talent and experience that I was about to cross the threshold into the world in which I was about to cross the threshold into. And that was another life-defining experience. Many of the aspects of directing and acting that I've come to know today are from observing people like Michael Mann and Michael Waxman and Daniel Day-Lewis. The best classroom in the world is being in the company of these people as they do their work. And they are consummate craftspeople. And again, I feel that the good fortune that I've had to be able to be around these people, especially at such a critical age in my development as a storyteller, where you could go into those things with ego and youth and hubris and not learn a thing, or you can go in and recognize that you're in the best classroom that you could have ever dreamt and try to soak in everything, learn from everybody. And that's the approach I took, because I find excitement and always want to be learning something new. There's always somebody better. There's always somebody that can teach you something. Look for the good, look for the, you know, and sometimes it's mutual. Sometimes there's some aspect of your craft or your personality that rubs off and affects them in a positive way. I make no assumptions that that happens, but my hope is that somewhere along the line, it's a mutual exchange on some level. But that would be a very difficult assumption or thing to hope with somebody like Michael Mann, because, you know, it's not like you're going to teach him something. But hopefully through the competent execution of your craft, you're at least able to contribute to the overall design and execution of his vision for a picture such as Last of the Mohicans, and participating in that and seeing it again on a granular level on how something like a scalped head or some wounds or some bullets, you know, it's a lot of the different kinds of things that we were called on to execute on that picture, how they contributed to the whole. And I knew the massive amount of work that we did just to create those things, and then extrapolate out the massive amount of work it took to make the costumes, the massive amount of work it took to build the sets, massive amount of work, and then up that pyramid.
Right.
Until you get like Michael Mann, who has every single one of those details in his mind and in binders. He is the type of director that studied how the different levels of bacteria at that time in history would less bacteria, so that if you got wounded or a certain, you know, compromised immune system or whatever, how it would affect you. Would you recover from a knife wound? What was the biome? What was nature like back then? He thinks about all of those things. And as a student of storytelling, I started to realize that every single aspect matters. Everything informs something else. And that's the organizing idea that it is, I think, the foundation of storytelling, is how do you tie all of those disparate, meaningful things into the whole? Because when you watch the film, you're not thinking about 90% of the things he thought about, probably.
Right.
But because he thought about them, and people like James Cameron and Martin Scorsese, and they or any of the people who are consummate trash people.
Yeah. Wes Anderson.
Yes. That's the way they operate. And so having the opportunity to be in the company of those people and the privilege to work on something that they're designing and leading, you try to let as much of that rub off on you as possible, because even though you can try to emulate those people, but until you understand why they're doing what they're doing, you're only going to come off, as they say, with a cheap knockoff. You've got to understand fundamentally why those aspects of storytelling and craft are important and how they tie into the different narrative structures of the heroine's journey or the hero's journey or any version of the traditional three-act film, or how Quentin Tarantino knows the rules and knows how to break them to do something like a Pulp Fiction, or, you know, any iteration thereof. There's such a depth to it. And I didn't understand that. Even when I made my first and second movie as a director, I didn't understand the whys of writing, the whys of storytelling. I just knew that I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I was overeager, and I just got right to it. And I learned by making tons of mistakes, and I'm still learning. But at some point along the line, you reach a point where you become competent in a way that others recognize as competence, and that your ability to tell a story is interpreted by an audience in a similar fashion as you intended it to be. Meaning, you conceive of a story and you hope that the end result lands in a certain way and has a certain result. And the closer those are together, I think, is some sort of measure on how effectively you've designed and executed your work. That's just my interpretation of it. You know, I'm sure that's probably just, you know, exclusive to me. Probably everybody has their own process.
Right. But
you go down these rabbit holes of why do you do the things, how do you do the things that you do? You know, they're all extensions of those experiences with all of those people that I've had the good fortune to meet. And, you know, even Imagineering, the design process and the storytelling and the theming, they go out of their way to create narratives for all of the architectural decisions that are made, all of the theming decisions. It's all about storytelling. And I've come to the conclusion, and I hope this doesn't sound naive or overimportant at the same time, is that I think storytelling might be the most important thing that civilization has, because it's ultimately, it's the way we relate, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all have stories, whether we don't literally tell stories in the terms of writing or filmmaking or song singer, songwriter or whatever, but we're all telling stories. Like, what's the story we have of ourselves, and how do we want to present to the world? What's the story of my interaction as a CEO or business person or a person who changes oil? Like, what's the story of our life? What are we crafting, and how do we interact with people? And, you know, so I do think that storytelling is possibly the most important thing that civilization has as a foundational way to relate to each other.
Yeah. Wow. I love it. I am curious about the set, unless the Mohicans. You know, Daniel Day-Lewis is, of course, infamous for staying in character throughout the course of a shoot. Last of the Mohicans, as I understand it, was particularly brutal for him. And I'm just curious what it was like observing Daniel Day-Lewis, if you had a chance to. It's not like you weren't busy, right? But what that was like.
Well, the experience, Daniel Day-Lewis is, look, and there's people that know him much, much, much more intimately and over a longer course of period of time than myself. But my recollection of Daniel Day-Lewis is that he was a very shy, retiring individual who was always focused on what he was doing. And I did have occasion, I spoke to him, I sat next to him once, we were having lunch. You know, we just talked. And he talked about his poet laureate father and, you know, where he's from and things like that. But I think part of him was always in the world. I mean, he was in the wardrobe and everything. So part of him was always in the world of what he was doing. And I know that, for example, on Lincoln, he stayed in the character till the end. And it's not to say that he didn't come out of it to say hello to somebody or something. But I think what that means, and I'm guessing here based on my experiences, is that like 90% of the time he's the character. But, you know, when I saw him on the set and he was working, he was just what you'd expect a consummate practitioner of his craft would be, is that he always was prepared. He was always on point. He embodied as much as one could through training. There was boot camps at the front of the picture where they would spend weeks and weeks and weeks just learning firing, running through the woods, with firearms, shooting the weaponry, using the different types of knives and implements of protection and survival of that era. And he had all of them down. I'll share a little story.
Yeah.
He and Madeline Stowe, as they would leave the set, would always get into these races, you know, and who could get off the set first. And they would play practical jokes on each other. One time, Daniel came to me and asked if I could help with one of the practical jokes. And the idea was that he wanted his driver, they were going to race ahead of Madeline Stowe and her driver. And we were in an apple orchard, base camp, and all the trailers were in this apple orchard up near Chimney Rock in North Carolina. We were doing the work at the end of the picture where they're on the falls and the fight between Madwa and Chingachgook and that whole sequence up there. So to get to the set, you had to, you know, four-wheel drives. Base camp was probably 20 minutes on a long drive on four-wheelers out to this apple orchard. So he asked if I could make up his driver to look as if he'd gone through the windshield or something like that. I said, yeah, of course. You know, just, you know, well, he wanted it to be secret. He didn't want anybody to know. So they stuck into the trailer after they had been wrapped. And they had been wrapped a little bit earlier than Madeline Stowe. So we got his driver all bloodied up and shirt ripped and all this stuff. And apparently, as he recounted the day after, he came to tell me how it went. They drove up a slight embankment and hit an apple tree and, you know, laid the scene. And Madeline came and saw this and got hysterical. And then realizing what he had done, then began hitting him. So as much as Daniel would stay in character and absolutely show up for those moments, he would, on occasion, come out of that world to do things like that. From what I understand, and even witnessing that event, he's got a great sense of humor and is, I think, probably a practical joker at heart on some level. And I'd heard him in an interview say that people always take him more seriously because he just happens to wear the face of somebody who looks serious and has a certain countenance to him. But he's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person. And unfortunately, for me, I've not really had the opportunity to encounter him past that picture. But I remember like it was, you know, last month. And again, we're talking about things that influence you and things that leave a resonating mark on your mind and your process. And he's certainly one of those people. And I have great gratitude for the good fortune and his generosity of spirit to interface in the way he did. One time, Mike Waxman, they were testing this blood knife. And Michael Waxman, who knew me from Drop Dead Fred, the first assistant director, he was another kind of a father figure. And he always kind of looked out for me and would involve me in ways that you wouldn't necessarily have the opportunity to be involved in a normal set, day-to-day set goings on. And so the testing of this knife, he found me among all of these people. He found me, you know, with his eyes and he waved me over. And so Daniel A. Lewis and got to test this knife a couple of times on me. You know, we went through the process of the scene and Michael Mann was there working out the details. And I was this 18-year-old kid getting to interact with these, you know, basically they're like CEO level practitioners of their craft. They're like the top of their game. Daniel Delbert already won an Academy Award. Michael Mann was well steeped in his craft over numerous pictures and decades at this time. And I was getting to witness and participate in this process. And Daniel helped me up. You know, blood exploded. The knife was a pneumatic trigger. Daniel pushed the button and blood would spray out as he pretended to cut my neck on the ground. He had dropped me down, cut my neck. And this, you know, the knife had too much CO2 in it. Blood exploded up all over my face. So it was pretty startling, I think. But he helped me up and put his arm around me. He said, good show, good show. In his British accent, you know, as he was rehearsing, he was speaking as Daniel, not in the voice of Hawkeye. And so it was those little moments that for a young person that was in a world just vast and huge, it made an impression. These are things that I'll remember my whole life and look back on and with appreciation and gratitude, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. That's wonderful. What a great memory to have, Chris. I'd love to know what the experience was like getting to work on Final Destination.
So Final Destination, I was working with at a company called Cinema Production Services. And that was run by Mike Joyce. And he had a history in the business just to give you a little background, he'd done work with James Cameron on The Terminator and like they doing miniatures and visual type effects. And so what we were engaged to do on, we worked on a couple of Final Destinations, but the one that, that I remember most clearly was, maybe it was part three, it involved a subway crash. And so we built the entire subway platform and the tunnels and the trains. And one of the key people on that picture was Gene Rizzardi. Now, Gene Rizzardi built, or was one of the people who ran the show building the Titanic for James Cameron's movie Titanic.
Wow.
And that had been the historical aspect of Titanic, the real ship. I had been fascinated with since reading A Night to Remember in my seventh grade English class with Mr. Stina, who was a teacher who opened that world to me. And so when I got to meet Gene and learn about, you know, on the side, you know, talk about what went into that, making that ship, that was amazing aside. But in any case, we built the entirety of that subway platform. And it was, you know, those things ran, the miniature subways, which when I say miniature subway, cars were about 8 feet long. And they would run through, and John Sturber, who did the pyro effects on that picture, who also worked on my last, most recent picture, Journey to Royal, he created all of the sparks and the fire, the explosions of when it came apart, things like that. So it was an interesting experience in that I never built something or contributed to building something on that scale before. I'd done miniatures for my own pictures in the past and things like that, but this was on a different level. So it was not unlike other pictures, but again, the real joy of working on that picture was getting to meet, you know, Mike Joyce and Gene Rizzardi and Ken Swenson. We worked on the Poseidon concurrently, I think, with that picture. So I was getting to meet people who were at the peak of their craft and had done things I had vast amount of respect for and had studied coming up myself. So those were the real joys of working on those things. Not only the work is always fun.
Yeah.
The challenge of it, the intricacies of figuring out like how you're going to literally affect the build and then the effect based on the build, that's always great. But it's always, more often than not, for me, it's always about the people and their history. I love meeting people that love what they do and love to talk about what they do, because you gain insight into so much more than just the craft. You gain insight into a frame of mind, a why. The why is always the thing that interests me. Why do you do this? Why do you care? What about it fascinates you? What how did you learn to do this? Why did you make this choice? You know, and helps inform your own process, because the more you know and the more you understand about why people that are the best at what they do, why do they make the choices they make? It teaches you how to think about things and how to explore problem solving in storytelling. It's challenging to convey in this format the true appreciation that I have for these people. These people are all amazing. Again, I feel privileged to have been able to know them and work with them. I have nothing but gratitude and wonder at the craft of the people I've had the chance to work with.
That's great, Chris. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm very excited to speak actually about your most recent film, Journey to Royal, a World War II rescue mission. So please tell our listeners about it and what led you to start the project.
So Journey to Royal is about my great uncle, Royal Stratton. At least that's the framing story. He was a World War II rescue pilot who died saving 9 downed airmen in the South Pacific. And I came to know about my great uncle at family reunions when his widow, 60 some years on from his passing, whenever the mention of his name or his grandson would show up, who was the spitting image of Royal, whenever she would either see him or hear Royal's name, she would become nearly inconsolable, as if he had died last week or yesterday. And I was impressed. What moved me in that moment was, what about this person made such an impact on this, his widow, that all these years later, it's such a raw emotion, the recollection of that loss. Because we all lose people, we all move on, and many of us, we evolve to a point, I think, of fond reflection, but it doesn't have the emotional rawness that it did for her, for example. So that began my exploration. And finally, in 2009, my production partner, Mariana Tosca, and I found the last surviving member of Royal's crew. And we went to do and sort of an exploratory interview. My mindset was I was going to get an interview about this amazing history, write a narrative feature, and make a movie about it. And we videotaped the interview. Upon listening to this interview and meeting this person who was a participant in world history, I was just moved beyond words. And it became clear to me at that point in time that the story wasn't some fictionalized version of this. It was these people, the veterans themselves. And so I shifted gears internally and I thought, okay, this is going to be a narrative documentary hybrid, and that the veterans have to be the voice of this story. It has to be them telling their story about their participation on the world stage of what came to be some of the most pivotal turning points of the conclusion of World War II in the South Pacific. And so I had an organizing idea, a fundamental drive of what this narrative arc and story was going to be. But with documentary, unlike narrative filmmaking, you, as you interview people that participated in mind-blowing things, they dictate the direction of the story more than your concept of where you'd want to try to steer it. You can steer it to some degree, but when you interview somebody who was in the ocean for 5 days after the sinking of the USS Indianapolis, you listen to what that person had to say, and you let them shape where the story goes based on their experience. When you talk to the person who replaced my great uncle after his death, who flew the surrender documents to the USS Missouri, a task my great uncle would have been charged with had he survived, and then was there at the signing, you listen to those sorts, and they shaped the overarching narrative. And this was a picture that was born out of my need to know my great uncle and to try to fill the hole that was still vacant. Like, his absence in our family was still having impact all these generations later. And I was trying to honor that legacy of who he was and what he did through the creation of this film, and by extension, allowing our family to know who he was beyond the history books by interviewing and telling the story of everybody that knew him, that flew with him in the squadron, and then the larger umbrella of that picture as it naturally evolved was to tell the greater story of the squadron that he served with, which is how you get into the rescuing of the people of the USS Indianapolis, the eyewitness of the first atomic bomb over Hiroshima, the flying of the surrender documents. I know what you do with your podcasts here, and it's the reason I personally think it's so important and so relevant more than ever, is because we're participants in the preservation of a history that, if not for people like you and people like me and the other people who seek to preserve the voices of history, this history would be lost.
Yes.
And in many cases, and you know this, I know you must feel this in what you do. You're the last thread that connects somebody and their voice to an audience that might have no knowledge of their intimate interaction with history. And if I did nothing else, and I hope to do many other things, believe me,
yes,
if I did not, being the custodian of that history and my great uncle's history and the squadron and the work with my production partner on that, this perhaps will be the most important, personally important and fulfilling work that I've ever had the privilege to do.
Well, this won't be a surprise to you that you hit on something that means a lot to me, which is the preservation of history. As you said, I had the honor, I think you know this, of interviewing a Holocaust survivor who was in prison in Auschwitz, Gene Klein. Had him on twice, actually. And that was the first interview I'd ever done where I'd felt a real responsibility to history. He was in the camp at 16 years old. When I interviewed him last year, I think he was 96, you know? So you think collecting those stories is so crucial. I mean, we think of even 5 years from now, how many of these people will still be around to tell their story?
Right.
You know?
And if not for you, if not for me, if not for, and on a bigger scale, people like Steven Spielberg and Schindler's List and the like-minded people that see the value in preserving this and the literal voice, in your case, the literal voices of those people and me as well. We made a promise to these veterans that we would do everything in our power to make sure their legacy and their history was preserved, and that audiences were provided an opportunity and a venue to be able to see this. And we've been lucky that the film, even during the pandemic, the film got released. It's out on Amazon, you know, Google Play, iTunes, the places that you can go to stream these things. You can find the picture. And just last month, it was in Kevin Smith's inaugural film festival in New Jersey. And I had an opportunity to speak to one of the head person on the selection committee. And that was a gentleman who had discovered Kevin Smith, Sundance. And he made a point to say how the picture had impacted him. And he was a veteran of Korea. And you start to realize that the work has impact and it does resonate with people. And when you hear back from those people about what it meant to them and what they took from it, you begin to realize that on some small scale, we are doing the job. We are preserving that history. It is making impact. It is going forward and being preserved through the audiences and the minds of people who resonate with the work that we've done in order to provide that channel, that history, through the voices of the people that we both, you know, had the opportunity to meet and speak with. I can't think of, first of all, it's a privilege to be a custodian to that history,
yeah,
as you well know.
Absolutely.
The other is that knowing, being in the company of those people, there's a reverence to that experience. And it's hard, it's almost ineffable, the quality of those experiences and meeting those people and the metal and the caliber of character that you interface in these people that put their lives on the line to preserve an idea of freedom in the best case scenario. You know, it's something that I think everybody should have an opportunity to experience because it does change your perspective about how you view the world and how you view the things that I think most people take for granted on a daily basis. When people say the greatest generation or the people that fought in World War II literally are responsible for our way of life, I don't know that that resonates with a lot of young people today because we're so, again, granular into our devices and our lives. And it's not to say that we shouldn't enjoy every modern thing. It's just that we are here as a result of the blood, sweat, tears, and courage of other people. And to not somewhere in your mind and your daily just pay tribute or at least some form of respect to the groundwork that has been laid for our easy lives, I think you're missing out on something.
I couldn't possibly agree with you more, Chris. And I'm keeping an eye on my time, on our time here. But just one more reminiscence I wanted to share with you. I had the pleasure of interviewing Colonel Bud Anderson, who is the oldest living triple ace fighter pilot from World War II.
Wow.
Yeah, the year I interviewed him, he had just turned 100. Yeah, and I remember just capping on the whole respect thing. My gear up, my ramp up preparing for that discussion was basically saying to myself, all right, listen, you, this man, you know, has done things that have allowed you to live and you will come into the interview and you will come correct. Yes, sir. No, sir. You know, then this was, really was the inner voice I was having in my head. And I was grateful that the interview was well received and the rest of it. And you're right. There's a real sense of reverence and that. It's just a different breed of people, the greatest generation. They really are. I've had the honor of interviewing many of them, as I suspect you know, and I'm in awe every time I'm on a call with any of them.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
You know, just a brief aside to that, and I spoke about this when we're having our kind of pre-interview conversation.
Right.
At first, when we embarked upon making this picture, we were very eager and enthusiastic when we would call these veterans and they would invite us to do these interviews. Or allow us to, rather. And very quickly, we learned that, to realize that we were, in some occasions, most occasions, asking them to relive some of the worst memories of their life. And so that was incongruous with the kind of excitement that we were bringing because we were just seeing the privilege of being able to hear their stories. And it's not that we were unaware of the gravity of those things. It's just that those were at the forefront. And after the first or second interview, we began to realize what we were asking these people and asking them to tell their story. And so we then had a no less enthusiastic approach, but it was tempered in a way that made it appropriate.
And
it had the appropriate reverence and respect. And it's not that that was devoid previously. It's just that when you're excited to be in the company of somebody, sometimes that youthful enthusiasm leads in a way that's...
It vets out in a weird way.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I understand that.
Not as helpful,
you know? Kind of like asking, you know, if I'm like a war veteran, you know, so did you ever kill anyone? Like,
right.
It's a question that you know you shouldn't ask. Sometimes curiosity just pulls it out of you.
Right. And, you know, we did a lot of, look, I know you probably do this, I do this. Whenever you're going to go sit in front of somebody, I write a list, all the questions and the sub questions and things like that. And sometimes I have a list of things not to say and things not to ask or in a certain way. And I knew that chief among them would be no questions like, did you ever kill anybody? Or, you know, certain things. I knew that certain things would just be, as I'm sure you know, be inappropriate and
bad form.
Bad form. It would betray a trust of conduct and tact and the ultimate goal of truthful sharing and not in some sort of exploitative way. I know, as you are, we're there to share their history, not to capitalize on the if it bleeds, it leads mentality.
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Speaking my own language, Chris. Well, I tell you what, Chris, I could talk with you all day, but I think I'll finish off by asking you, Chris Johnson, how can people find out about you, sir?
There's a website for Journey to Royal. It's journeytoroyal.com. I have a personal website called chrisjohnsonfilms.com. And you can find myself, the film, my production partner, who's an amazing photographer and producer and storyteller in her own right. That's Mariana Tosca at toscaphotography.com. It's at www.toscaphotography.com. So those three places, journeytoroyal.com, chrisjohnsonfilms.com, and toscaphotography.com. You're going to be able to find, by extension, anything you'd ever want to find out about myself, us, the work we're doing. So please, I invite you to come and share in some of our world and what we're doing.
Excellent. Chris, this was such a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Absolutely neutral, Josh. Thank you so much for the invitation.
My pleasure, sir. You take care and have a great weekend, okay?
You too.
Bye, Chris.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.